This is the Horse Radio Network.
What a beautiful day for horses in the morning.
Well, good Thursday morning, everybody. I am Glenn the Geek from Ocala, Florida.
And I am Mary Kitzmiller in Coleman, Texas. And you're listening to Horses in the Morning on the Horse Radio Network for April 14th, episode 1405. Today's show is brought to you by Horseware. Good morning, Horse World.
What is your favorite day of the week?
You never stop learning. You never stop understanding. It's more in depth than just riding a horse. Knowing that for the rest of my life I could work on this and I'll never stop learning.
Well, good morning, everybody. Thank you for joining us on this Thursday morning. And what Mary didn't mention in her opener is that she's coming to us from the cab of her truck in a parking lot in the middle of nowhere, Coleman, Texas.
I'm very surprised I actually found a Wi-Fi signal. My recording studio this morning is very sophisticated.
Where do you have the microphone? Is it like attached to the steering wheel? Or
it is on the console, and my laptop is in my lap, and so I'm looking at my notes, but then I've got my head craned sideways to make sure you can hear me in the microphone. And I'm in a parking lot. So my biggest fear this morning is that they're going to come over and tell me I need to move. So I'll be probably driving and talking at the same time, trying to find a new spot that also catches the Wi-Fi.
Well, and let's hope that you don't get mugged. That's the other thing. So,
Oh, no, not out here. I won't.
No, Coleman, we were joking about it, looking at it on the map. You are truly in the middle of nothing there in Coleman, Texas.
Yes, there's some deer stands and lots of places to buy deer hunting paraphernalia. So my guess is they like to hunt out here, and it's south of Abilene. We're here for a show, and the show's called Petticoats on the Prairie, and we're selling our artwork here. My mom and I are, and so I knew I was going to be out here Thursday morning, and I thought, no big deal. I'll just find a Starbucks. It'll have some Wi-Fi. I can do the show from there. So I start looking up Starbucks, and it's like the nearest Starbucks is in Dallas, which is 3 hours from here. So then I start getting a little nervous. I'm like, okay, do you have a McDonald's? And there's no McDonald's. There's a China Walk. There's a new pizza place. So that's good. But yeah.
Well, we're glad you could get reception there. I was afraid you wouldn't even have phone reception, let alone internet.
Oh, yes. Yeah. I was keeping an eye on my bars going all the way down. I'm like, if I have to drive to Abilene, which is quite a ways north of us, I will.
That's how dedicated Mary is.
Yeah. Luckily, I'm at the rodeo grounds, and there's great Wi-Fi here, knock on wood.
Well, I want to go to Jennifer right away here to tell us what's coming up on today's show.
Coming up on today's Mary Kitzmiller Horsemanship episode, brought to you this month by Horseware, it's all Q&A. Today, as Mary's going to answer some listener-submitted training queries, and our guest, Jeff Sanders, is going to answer the question, what is a California bridle horse? I'm very curious about that. And go out and try some training yourself today, because it's National Reach As High As You Can Day. So there you go.
Well, there you go. And actually, Jeff Sanders coming on later is a response to a listener question, too, wasn't it, Mary, about hackamore training?
Oh, yes. We had him on a couple months ago and kind of touched on the subject a little bit about hackamore training. And I know I've gotten a few people who are interested in learning more about it because, you know, we didn't get to go really in depth into it. So we're going to have him back on to answer a few more questions about not only the hackamore, but the tradition and the history of the bridle horse.
I had never heard of the California bridle horse. I thought you spelled it wrong until I looked it up.
I always double check. Well, a couple of words get thrown around when talking about this type of riding, and some people may call it vaquero horsemanship. But vaquero can actually mean a couple of different things. It might encompass a few different styles. So California, actually right around where I was a few years ago for the Horsemen's Reunion, the San Luis Obispo area, and the town just slipped my mind. But that's sort of the cradle of the whole California style of training. And you know, there were sort of two branches of Western riding that came up in the West. There's one which I would call more the Texas style, and you know, in areas of the country where there was more conflict and the need to get a horse going really good, really quick. And then in California, for many, many years, there was fertile land. There wasn't a lot of conflict. There was a lot of time. And so their style involved bringing the horse along really slow. They had a lot of time to make beautiful tack. And, you know, that's where you see those gorgeous braided hackamores. And so it's a really, really interesting style. It's one I've been interested in for the last few years. And it's starting to become more popular. And there's a lot of myths. There's some misconceptions and a lot of interesting history. So I figured Jeff would be a really great person to talk with about that.
Sounds good. And that's coming up a little later. We have some listener questions we're going to get to first for Mary and Jennifer. We're going to tackle some training questions this morning, a whole bunch of them, actually. But first, I wanted to just talk a little bit about Zenyatta's baby. We announced yesterday that Zenyatta had a baby, and then we found out yesterday that the colt actually died at the hospital. Due to complications of meconium aspiration syndrome, and we want to send our best out to mommy, to Zenyatta, and also to all the contacts over there. Zenyatta has been moved. She's fine. She's been moved back to the farm at Lane's End, and she's been put out with her old buddy. And so she has a friend now in the field and to help her get over, because Zenyatta has tended to be a very good mommy. So she definitely will be missing this colt. Now, I asked Jennifer to look up what, you know, because we didn't know what meconium aspiration syndrome was yesterday when we talked about this. And basically, meconium is a foal's first manure. It is typically passed during the first 12 to 24 hours of life. However, it can be expelled while a foal is still in utero. If this happens, a foal can aspirate feces during its first breaths. So meconium aspiration can lead to severe pneumonia, symptomatic infection, and death, and then that's what happened in this case. So basically, they inhale their own feces in utero, which, you know, they basically suffocate themselves is what ends up happening. Had you heard of this?
I have. You know, meconium is something when I was working at Raining Barns and we're foaling out. I mean, it's one of the first things we look for after the foal's born to make sure they're healthy. I'd never heard of them expelling it in the uterus. So this is the first time I've heard of the aspiration syndrome, but I can totally see how it would, you know, make the foal go septic. And I think what actually kills the foal is probably an infection that they get as a result of inhaling that. And these little babies, I tell you what, you know, when they go south, it is really, really hard to bring them back sometimes. You had to know, I mean, you know, this foal had to have had the best care in the world.
Yeah, he was over at Rude and Riddle. I'm sure that they were working overtime for this baby.
It's so sad. Now, she has one foal that I think is racing now. Is that right?
She has two, actually. This was her fourth. Jennifer, tell me if I got this wrong. But this was her fourth. One actually had died. There are two left. One that's doing pretty well racing and one that's not. Right, Jennifer? Jamie knows all this by heart. But
yes. She has two colts who are of racing age. Both have had starts. Her third foal, the filly, was in a paddock accident and had to be euthanized. she got into a wreck with another horse in the field, and it went south.
Oh, what a shame.
Yeah, so poor Zenyatta, she's sort of cursed. You know, she's had a tough time with it.
But, well, you know, I think someone commented
that they lost. It was just completely an accident.
Yeah.
I mean, I think from the sound of it, again, I've just heard of this syndrome. I mean, it sounds like both incidents were just a fluke, because I think someone did comment on a post, you know, well, why do they keep breeding her? It's like, this really isn't like a genetic thing.
Yeah, and the other one was an accident. So, you know.
Yeah. You know, I think in both cases, it's. Yes.
Yeah, it's just that when it's more high profile, you hear about it, and in this case, and you know what, if a mommy's going to have 6, 7, 8 babies over a lifetime, things are going to happen to the babies. They're not all going to be perfect, healthy babies. You know, things happen. It's just a law of numbers there. You know,
and again, it comes back to go south.
Everything we say, you know, horses just will find ways to kill themselves, and here in this case, it's even in uterus. Sheesh.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, these babies, no matter how vigilant you are, when they start to go south, it's crash and burn. It's very hard, you know, in some cases to keep them going. And you know, that's why you got to be vigilant with them. But even then, you know, if you've got a foal at Rood and Riddle and in the best care in the world, just sometimes things happen.
Well, our best to all of them, and of course, we'll keep Zenyatta in mind, and we'll actually be in near Zenyatta's Lane's End Farm here in 2 weeks in Lexington. Well, we have some. I put out a call for questions and got a bunch of them, and I said, "Well, Mary and Jennifer are both going to be there. We have Coach Jen and we have Trainer Mary here, and we thought, well, one comes a little bit more from the English side than the other, so it'd be perfect to ask whatever questions, and you two could handle them. So, if you want, we can get started with that. Just give us a really quick update, Mary, on Moonshine and his training. Your thoroughbred going to the thoroughbred competition the end of the year."
Yes, he's doing really well. Actually, and this is my question for the listeners, I've got him on a diet of, he's got hay in front of him 24/7. He's got alfalfa. He's got really good quality pellet grain, which I've just upped the dosages on, but he has lost a little bit of weight. And this is, I'm used to quarter horses that get fat off of air. So I am very interested if any of you all have any good tips for putting weight on
Jennifer has had stringy thoroughbreds before. So what do you recommend?
Fat. Choose your fat source.
I was going to start putting him on something with a high source of those omega fatty acids. And
It's nice to be able to get one that's also got the omegas in it. We use a lot of flax here, ground flax, which I love because it's got a high fat content, but it's also got all sorts of other good stuff in it. You can rice bran is also very popular if you get stabilized rice bran. Hugely popular. If you use liquid fats, it's nice because it's all 100% fat versus the powdered kinds, which also have fiber
and it's easier for them to drop the powder. And to be clear, he still looks good. And probably a lot of this is my eyes that are trained on quarter horses.
You're used to looking at quarter horses, Mary.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Are looking at this and I'm like, oh, this poor lanky thoroughbred, what should I do?
Yeah, by the way, he starts to look like your quarter horses, put him on a diet.
He should not look like Guthrie.
No.
Guthrie's morbidly obese and he's on nothing. He cries at me all day. He gets crappy coastal hay, you know, and he gets a few flakes of that and he's on like a taste of grain and he is morbidly obese. So that horse.
Well, enjoy your skinny horse then.
Yes.
All right, let's tackle the first question. Is from Casey. Auditor Casey says, any suggestions for a horse that spins circles when being mounted? She's fine bareback, but as soon as she sees me step behind the shoulder, it's a totally different story.
Interesting. So she's fine to get on bareback. Okay, so There's a lot of exercises you can do to get your horse to stand still. But the one thing I would ask is, if your horse is otherwise fine with ground manners and things like that, what are they telling you when they don't want you to get on? Now, most of us, the instinct is to, you know, move them in some circles, or maybe back them up, or reprimand them a little bit, you know, tell them no, and then you get on and ride off, because our goal is to ride. I want to get on and ride you today. But what I found is, if my horse is spinning around or moving backwards or being silly when I try to mount, that tells me my ride's not going to be really good. You know, if I have to kind of get on like the Pony Express to ride you, it's not a good start to the ride. So I will spend the time it takes to make sure they stand still while mounted. And there's a lot of things you can do to help this. There's a lot of simple groundwork. Some folks might tell you, oh, make the wrong thing easy, or make the wrong thing difficult and the right thing easy, or they might have you really hustle the horse for moving around. I'll move their feet and I might even use a little bit of energy, but oftentimes when they're moving like that, it's more out of anxiety than general playfulness. So you may need to take them to the round pen and move them around a little bit, get the energy, you know, take the edge off. But one of the things I really like to do is teach them how to side pass up to a mounting block or a fence to come get me. And it's pretty simple to do. I do it based off of my ability to be able to send a horse back and forth. I teach a horse first, if I lift up on the rope, I need to be able to send you forward. So I should be able to kind of pick up a little bit of feel on the lead rope, and they need to follow that feel and go forward. And then once they go past me, I lift the lead rope up toward their withers, and that will tell them to yield their hindquarters. And then I switch hands on the lead rope, lift my hand, let them feel that halter pulling them forward. They need to follow that feel. And once they go past me again, I have them yield. And I'll do that back and forth and back and forth until they get it really well. You can do this at high energy at a trot. I don't mind if they trot, but I actually prefer them to do it at a really relaxed and still forward walk. So if they're full of energy and they want to trot past each time, that's totally fine. My goal is to keep doing it until they want to relax and walk. So that's step one. And once I get that, then I'll go up to either a fence or mounting block, and I'll practice sending them past me from the fence or mounting block. And then I will start, and this is a little tricky to explain over the radio, but then as I send them past, I'll start kind of lifting my hands straight up to see if I can get them to come toward me and to start yielding toward me on the fence. And this is something I've seen a few people teach it this way. And when you first try, it feels very awkward and you're not sure if you're doing it right, and your horse isn't going to do the right thing to right off the bat, but just play with it. And what I'll do is I'll just kind of pick up on that halter, create a little feel on that halter and lead rope, and anything my horse does that even comes close to coming up to pick me up off the fence or the mounting block, I'll release. And I'll spend a lot of time petting them and rubbing them. If you're clicker training, this is a perfect chance to mark that good behavior with the click and then use a food reward. And I'll play with it as long as it takes, maybe 15 minutes, maybe it's an hour. And pretty soon the horse learns that the point of the exercise is, when I lift my hand in a certain way, they need to swing toward the fence and get nice and parallel with the fence. Now, once they're there, I'm not just going to say, okay, now we ride and get on. I'll spend that time scratching on their neck, you know, rubbing them up and down. If it's a colt that I'm starting for the first time and I'm getting them ready for the first ride, I'll pull on that saddle horn, make sure he's used to the saddle kind of pulling on his back. I've seen cowboys do this where they'll take their chaps off and kind of throw their chaps over the horse. And what I found that this does is the horse learns to kind of crave coming up to you on the fence, because it's a great period of rest. They get rubbed on, they get loved on. If you're training with the clicker, this is where you'd give them a nice food reward. And I'll work on it a little bit every day. And pretty soon, the horse will start craving that fence or that mounting block. And with Guthrie, I've done this a lot with Guthrie, especially before I even put the first ride on him. If I go stand on the mounting block, he'll come to me from anywhere in his pen and side pass right up to me. You know, it's part trick, but it's also because he really enjoys doing it. He gets a lot of rest time next to that mounting block. And then when you do get on, let's say, okay, your horse is now standing still, you're ready for a ride. Don't get on and gallop off. That's another thing, is sometimes we get on and we're, you know, okay, I was going to work on jumps today, or I was going to work on lead changes, and you warm them up just a little bit and you go. A lot of my more nervous and anxious horses, I make it a point to walk around the arena once on a loose rein. This is for my sake. It's to keep me from jumping right into the training. And if you do that, I find they let down a lot more at the beginning of the ride.
Jennifer, anything to add to that?
Anything to add to that? And you've probably already checked into this, our person who asked the question. If the horse is fine when you get on bareback.
That's what it caught me. I was hoping you'd bring that up.
Yeah. Yes.
When you get on with a saddle, that makes me question, is the saddle fitting properly? Number one. Number two, if you're mounting the saddle from the ground and not a mounting block, follow instructions previously outlined by Mary, teach your horse to come to the mounting block and use that, because he might be offended by the twisting that happens when you get in the saddle using the stirrup. The horse doesn't necessarily have to be in pain, chronic pain from it, but he still might find it offensive. I wouldn't blame him. So I would definitely check that as well. So check your saddle fit and teach your horse to stand in a mounting block if you don't do that already. Or if you're good at mounting bareback, which obviously you are, try getting on bareback, getting on the same way you would bareback with the saddle on. There you go.
Ooh.
See, my advice is much more superficial.
Well, no, you do bring up a good point, because the being fine bareback is, I think that is an important point. And something else you may look into is you may just kind of double check, make sure your horse is okay and doesn't have ulcers. You know, this is, it may or may not be, but sometimes, you know, they can be irritated by things wrapped around their belly. You know, saddle fit, like you said, could totally be playing a part, but horses that might be dealing with ulcers tend to be a little bit more, grumpy and finicky, when it comes to things around their belly you know, so there could be a difference. He might feel better without a saddle as opposed to with.
Very good.
Or she.
Sounds good. Now, this one comes from our coverage at Road to the Horse, and this is from Lindsay, who said, during Road to the Horse, Mary talked about horses being sticky and not forward. When you have a horse like this, what exercises do you use to help free them up?
Oh, yes. Okay, so sticky horses. And when I mean sticky, I mean a horse that
doesn't... You mean like flypaper sticky. That's not.
Yeah. No. Well, it's kind of like they're walking on flypaper. That's kind of what it looks like. And this, what I mean by sticky is they don't freely move forward. And a horse can be sticky even if they bolt. So, you know, there's just no flow to their movement. Their transitions, it's hard to get them to go into the next gate. And sometimes when you do finally get them to pop up into that trot or canter, they sort of jump forward and then they stop. They might pin their ears and toss their head and swish their tail a lot when you ask them to move forward. They might even kick out. Sticky horses, sticky colts are something I really look out for, because those tend to be the ones that buck when you put the first rides on. So I'm really a big stickler, so to speak, on getting a horse to move forward. And again, forward doesn't necessarily mean fast. It means they're relaxed and they can move out. So a couple of things to help fix a horse that's sticky. One is I'd make sure you're not in their face. You know, I know a lot of English riders prefer to have contact, and contact is fine, but make sure you don't have such a hold of their mouth that you're hindering them from going forward. I would actually prefer if I had a horse like this in for training, or I had someone taking a lesson, I'd probably have you ride all the way down to the buckle and really let that horse explore moving out. The area where you ride can also play a big part. If I'm starting a colt and I'm in the round pen and the colt's kind of pinning its ears, not moving forward easily, they want to kick up a little. To me, that's a good signal that I probably need to get out of the round pen and let the horse have more space to move. So if you're in a small pen, you might consider, if you can safely, riding them in the pasture or going to a bigger arena. And I would say work a lot on straight lines, letting them have their face. And then also transitions are very helpful. If my horse is lazy and I don't think I can keep him in a canter for very long, instead of working on trying to keep him cantering, I'm going to work on transitions. I'm going to first say, can I even get you to the canter? So I might work on getting a nice big extended trot. How much can I get you to extend that trot? And if you get them really, really good at extending that trot, then popping them into the canter becomes really easy. It's just a little bit more leg and they're in the canter. Once they find that gait, then I'll actually relax and let them settle right back down to that trot or even a walk. So for your lazy horses that don't have as much stamina, don't want to hold the canter as long, let them know that if you just try even a little bit, I'm going to reward you. And from there, you can start to build how long they stay in the canter. But if this horse thinks you're going to make him canter for half an hour, he's going to be a lot grumpier about wanting to stay in the canter because there's no reward for him.
Jennifer?
Interesting. I like that.
Yeah.
I like that a lot. And I discovered this with when I was getting ready to do Beaker's Western Dressage show. We struggled a bit with creating a beautiful and soft and relaxed dog. If it's soft and relaxed, it is not sticky. It's the opposite of sticky. And I used that exact technique in that if he would give me three steps of soft, not sticky jog where his top line was relaxed, that was it. We'd take a walk break. And then we do it again for three steps and we take a walk break. Because for him, taking a walk break is always a reward because that's his favorite thing to do. So that's great.
Same for Guthrie.
I feel validated now, Mary.
Good.
It works.
That's exactly what I would tell you to do. And I tell you what, for those of you who compete, my secret weapon that no one ever works on is transitions. Transitions are the keys to the kingdom. This isn't just walk to trot, trot to canter, canter back to trot. Think about how many gates you can have within the walk. So when I do clinics, I'll have people do kind of like a working walk where they're just, you know, walking along pretty relaxed, kind of forward, you know. But then there's the extended walk and we'll see how much can you get your horse to stretch out before he's has to break to trot. And that for a sticky horse is really hard to do because a sticky horse will either want to pop right into trot or they'll want to do their sticky walk. So find that extended walk. And then on the flip side of that, how slow can I get them to walk but still stay straight and not stop? And this is also very difficult. And when I'm doing a clinic with Western riders, I'll have them, you know, imagine the kind of walk you need to do to really gently push a cow forward or to hold a cow. If you've got a cow on one end of the arena, if your horse goes too fast, you'll lose the cow or you might push him forward too quickly. So you have to keep the cow going, but you have to walk so slow. You have to creep along so slow that you don't scare the cow into running off. So that's the thing I have them. And you can do this at the trot and the canter too. How slow can you jog before you have to break down? How big can you trot before you have to break into canter? And there's a million trillion little variations of each gait within that gait. And if you can get those worked out, your big maneuvers, your lead changes, your sliding stops, your anything you can think of, that will all iron itself out.
Very good. Well, thank you, Lindsay, for that question. We appreciate it. And we're very excited to announce that Mary's show now is titled Sponsored by Horsewear Products. And we're really excited about that. Horsewear has come on board to do Mary's show and also the Women in Rodeo show. Horsewear really is getting more into the Western world. People have thought of horsewear in the past kind of as an English side of products. But, of course, their blankets and their fly protection and things apply to all horses. It doesn't matter whether you're Western or English. And one of the lines that they have is their Amigo line of fly protection products. So let's hear about that, and then we're coming back with our guest.
Another long, tough fly season is right around the corner. And the only choice for this fly season are the Amigo range of fly sheets, because they're built tough and feature the latest in design comfort, bug-busting technology, and sun-protecting fabrics. And the Amigo range has a fly sheet for every budget, from the Amigo Bug Buster Vamoose with no fly zone to the Amigo Bug Rug Fly Sheet. Find Amigo fly sheets at your local or online retailer, or you can visit horseware.com. That's horseware, horsewear.com.
And you can also find them on Facebook. Just search for Horsewear. All right, Mary, we're ready.
Okay, so our first guest is Jeff Sanders, and he's out of Central California and an expert in the California or bridle horse style of horsemanship. And you are calling in from Australia, is that right?
Yeah, we're in a little bit different time zones, I think, right now.
You're like 2 in the morning. What are you doing up?
No, it's only 11 at night. It's not too bad.
Okay.
So is it 11 Wednesday night or Thursday night? This really trips me up.
Oh, good question. Thursday. It's Thursday.
Okay, so you're way ahead of us.
That's right. There. Yep.
A little bit, yeah, a little bit. And upside down, down under and upside down.
Where the toilets flush backwards.
Oh, yes.
Exactly.
That is one of the big reasons to go to Australia, I'm told.
Well, it is beautiful cattle country, too, so that's kind of nice.
So you're in Adelaide, Australia, and you're teaching clinics.
Yeah, we've got a cow working clinic, horsemanship and cow working clinic for the next 5 days here, about an hour out of Adelaide.
Oh, right on. And so is it kind of just a general cow work clinic? Are you going specifically into the kind of the style that you do? Is there a lot of interest for that there?
We've got a few days of horsemanship, so we'll have quite a few people in the Hackamore. I know we've got at least one really good two-rein horse, a guy named Steve Halfpenny here.
We're gonna go ahead and
work cows a little bit, and it'll be geared mostly towards the ranch work. There's a local rancher that's gonna host us at his place to kind of play with the cows and move them around a little bit.
Oh, small world. The folks that I was doing clinics with in Poland, they rode with Steve Halfpenny in Australia.
Oh, yeah. Well, he's the one hosting the clinic here.
Right on, right on. So we were going to talk a little bit about the California style. And I know the last time you were on, we did delve a little bit into it in Hackamore training, and since have had a few people that were really interested in the interview and wanted to know more about it. And so you, I'm looking at your bio, you're a sixth generation Californian, and it's been in your family for a while, and really that style, obviously the California style, sort of started there, and I'm seeing that it's getting a lot more popular over the years. So I want to ask, we see kind of two different styles of horsemanship that developed. There's one I'd call more, I would say it's more the Texas style, and then this style over on the West Coast sort of developed pretty differently. So I had my own guesses as to why that is. So what are your thoughts on that, on the difference between the Western style of riding in different areas of the country?
Well, I think one of the big things is that in California, at least, you know, up until, I don't know, 30, 40 years ago, it was still really considered much of an art form. So it wasn't just about getting the work done. My dad always said that, you know, anybody can do the job. It's about doing the job with class and with style. And I think a lot of it was more of a cultural thing. I think that we kept a lot of that Spanish pride in the horsemanship in California. I think that the Texas style is much more of a European mindset with a very strong work ethic, which is a great thing. But it's much more focused, I think, on the job and getting the job done, where in California, it's always been much more focused on not just the job, but doing the job with, you know, as much style and class as you could get. So it really maintained a lot of that artistic quality that we might not find in other places quite so much.
Well, and I have to say, I'm very much into aesthetics. So I think the first thing that drew me to this style is the equipment, because it is gorgeous. And there's still a few wonderful makers out there today that do some amazing stuff. I love the Hackamores. And so I got into it because it was pretty.
Nothing wrong with that. And the silver, you know, all the silver on the bridles and all of that, that is part of the artistic part of the horsemanship, that, you know, we honor the horses with that little extra silver when, you know, when they get to a certain point in their training. And we want our stuff to look good, and we want our horses to look good, and we want to take pride in ourselves and our horses and everything that we're doing.
Well, that brings up a really good point, because there's a lot of little quirks and differences in equipment, and these, some of these things are purely just very beautiful and ornate, and some of them really have meaning. What do you call it? One of the things I was seeing guys do is they were shaving little notches in their horse's mane. Is that something you do? And if so, what's the meaning behind that?
I don't. There are quite a few guys that do. A lot of that was to identify certain horses within your herd, you know, within the cavy, that where they were in their training. And this is also a little bit of a difference between more of the buckaroo culture and the California vaquero culture, where a lot of the buckaroos and cowboys, they move around a lot. Where I grew up, most of the guys, you know, the old guys, in the old days anyway, a lot of those guys were born and raised and died on the same ranch. So that wasn't used quite as much on some of those ranches, because the horse that you started as a five-year-old, you might be riding that same horse 20 years later. You had your horses that you rode, and guys didn't swap horses around quite as much as they do at a lot of the ranches these days. But that technique is still used quite a bit in the Great Basin and a lot of other places to identify different horses and where they're at in their training.
Well, and something else that I saw that I always thought was really neat is, you know, some folks will ride with a get down rope, which is a rope that'll go back to the saddle that you can use to lead the horse around. And then some folks will have a rope that goes around the horse's neck, and it's tied in sort of a Celtic looking knot. And I believe that's called the Alamar knot. Is that something that you do or you've seen as well?
Absolutely. That Alamar knot is really the final test of a good bridle horse. A lot of people think it's just for show, just for parade, that, you know, for just for being pretty, but it's really not. There are a number of tests along the way, like a lot of people have heard about tying some tail hair or some string between the reins and the bridle, is that being the test? But actually, that's not the case. That's really the test that you're even ready to go straight up in the bridle. The Alamar knot is kind of the final test. If you can go brand calves all weekend and not pick up your bridle rein and just use that Alamar knot, and your horse stays in self-carriage, stays in collection, works smooth, And that beautiful flower that Alamar knot is doesn't wad up because you can't pull on it like a necrope. If you can do that, then that's the final test of a really good bridle horse.
Wow. Well, yeah. And that's something that I think is maybe a little bit of a misconception is, you know, you see the big bits that a lot of these horses carry and you think, oh my gosh, that's just terrible. But really, so much of that system of training is based off of signal and not leverage. Like, you know, many Western bits it's all about leverage and torque and how, you know, if I pull on this, how much will it make my horse give to the bridle? And with the California style, I've noticed that it's really about, you know, can I just lay this rein across your neck and can just that weight of the buttons of the rein on your neck have you respond?
Yeah, really, when we're looking at what we would consider an old style bridle horse, you're only looking at 5 or 10% of the signal even coming from the bit at all. The way the bits are designed, like you said, they're not designed to be used with a lot of leverage. It's just that little movement of the brace or of the cannon, the mouthpiece in that horse's mouth should be enough of a signal for that horse to understand what it is that you're asking. And it's a lot different than we see a lot of the way people are riding today. Like you said, with, you know, the bigger bits or switching bits a lot, you know, I think Dr. Miller put it the best. He said, we're a tool using species. And when we have a problem, we grab a tool. And a lot of times that tool is the bit. But for us in this style of horsemanship, it's really not, because we've already trained the horse in the hackamore. And that's one of the big differences, is that we train the horse to get the horse ready for the bit. We don't use the bit to train the horse.
Yeah, I've heard it put that way too, you know, where I think there's some modern horsemanship, and I've been a part of this myself, where the horse flunks out of the bit. So, okay, I've ridden you on a snaffle for a year and you're getting pretty heavy, so it's time to go to the leverage bit. And then I ride in this kind of shorter shank leverage bit for so long. You're starting to get a little dull. It's time to go to the bigger leverage bit, and it's got the 8-inch shanks and it's got a little bit more torque to it. It's got a higher port and so on and so forth. And then you find it's almost like an arms race. The horse gets heavier, the heavier the bit you use. So then you have to get a heavier bit, and then your horse gets heavier. And pretty soon you're going to have to hotwire the bit. And and someone, it, you know, when
I like says, that arms race, I'm going to steal that.
Okay, you totally, it's yours to use. But yeah, when someone first put it to me, like, you know, I don't want my horse to flunk out of the bit. I want him to graduate to the bit. And I think a lot of us, whether we realize it or not, have that mindset. So then, of course, when you see the spade and it looks like quite a bit, you're like, oh, what'd that horse do? You know, he must be really heavy.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing, is that there's so much misunderstanding about it. If you pull a spade bit, you've already failed. I mean, it's not designed to pull on the reins. And that's one of the things, another big difference is that so much of modern horsemanship is geared towards instant results. It's like the McDonald's drive-through of horsemanship. You drive through, you get your hamburger, you go on. And is it food? Well, technically, yeah, but it's not really filet mignon. It's just something to fill your belly. And what I look at with a lot of this is that a lot of the bits and a lot of the way a lot of the bits are designed and the way they're used is to get those short-term results, that instant gratification. And it's done without really thinking about long-term sustainable results. And there's a big difference between instant results and sustainable results, which is exactly what you're talking about with that arms race, where you constantly got to upgrade the weapon in order to get the attention of that horse. Where for us, we're looking at sustainable results, and the training's done in the hackamore. In fact, a lot of people, I think a lot of people end up going to a bit after riding in a hackamore because they flunk out of the hackamore also. And anytime that happens, Most of the time we blame the tool, and usually it's not the tool that's the problem. Usually it's the pilot, not the plane, that's crashed.
Oh yeah, and I have been there. You know, I've ridden in the Hackamore, and it's more than just being soft, because I thought, oh, I'm being really soft and gentle, and then pretty soon my horse, you know, what started as a little tug when I'd ask him to turn a certain direction became an outright brace. And with the Hackamore,
yeah,
you cannot, yeah, unless you put a bike chain in it, even then you cannot pull harder. You know, it's just not going to work. And so I had to say, okay, my knowledge has ended here. Let's go back to a snaffle. And, you know, and the horses had to help me out. And then each time I tried the Hackamore again, I thought, okay, I can do it a few weeks longer now and a few weeks longer. And I do want to, you know, we jumped to the spade. I do want to go back to the Hackamore, because that is really important. And I think a lot of folks have interest in it, even if they're not going to go to the spade. One of the things that I've noticed is there are some folks who will start in a snaffle, then move to the Hackamore, but you start in the Hackamore right away. What are your thoughts on the Hackamore versus starting with a snaffle bit?
Yeah, my first ride is in a Hackamore. And every ride after that is in a Hackamore until the horse is ready to go to the terrain and then the bridle. In fact, I don't even have a snaffle bit. I've started horses in them in the past years ago. I start horses a lot of different ways. And what I usually found was that I always end up coming back to my Hackamore. It's one of the things about the Hackamore is that it won't lie to you. If you're heavy, the horse will get heavy. You can't cheat it. There is no pain compliance. And because of that, sometimes you really have to think your way through things. But the other thing is that you're going to save that horse's mouth. I mean, you know, we've all been there on a young horse where the horse jumps sideways or breaks an half buck in or does something like that. And, I mean, it's natural human reaction to grab a hold of those reins and try to stop that train wreck. And when you're in the bit, all of that's going into that horse's mouth. And people don't really study the mouth enough, I think, and they don't realize just how easy it is to damage it or to create a pain memory in that horse's mouth that later is going to cause all kinds of trouble. So by starting in the Hackamore, riding the young horses in the Hackamore, we just avoid a lot of those pitfalls that end up creating big roadblocks in people's training later on. And you really have to ride more with your body in a Hackamore than most people realize. If you're in the way, if you're riding in a way that doesn't work with the biomechanics of the horse in terms of what muscles need to contract and which muscles need to relax, those kinds of things, then the horses are more likely to get heavy, and you're going to create resistance that way too. So it really does take a lot of thought. You can't just kind of muscle your way through it with a Hackamore for sure.
Now, I know there's a lot of folks who they like the look of a Hackamore and really interested in learning. If someone is not interested in maybe pursuing the bridle horse tradition, but they wanna go bitless, what would you tell them as far as is there any difference, or is one better than the other when it comes to a Hackamore versus a side pull, or a Hackamore versus a simple rope halter?
Yeah, the Hackamore just has a much greater level of sophistication in terms of the signal and the communication you can get with your horse, for a couple of reasons. One is that when it's fitted properly, it gently touches around the entire horse's face. And it's kind of like a comfortable pair of shoes. If they don't swap around, they don't move around, if they're too big, then you're not going to want to wear them very long. And if they're too tight, you're not going to want to wear them very long either. But because it touches that horse's face, and it shouldn't move on its own. These Hackamores that are big and open and flopping around, they're pretty worthless if you want to keep a horse in it for very long. But when they fit properly, you have a very, very consistent signal to your horse. And that, for the horse, is really important. They thrive on that consistency, where the side pull and the rope hauls are just, they don't provide that. And then the other thing is that the way that hackamore functions, you have a number of different things happening in terms of a light push on the side of the face, or a little bit of pressure on the nose, or a little bit of lifting under the chin. Different things that you can do with the hackamore that are just really difficult in a lot of the other bitless tools.
Yeah, I know with the rope halter specifically, there's no kind of frame with it, and it sort of just wallers around on the horse's face. Not that you can't ride with one, and I've seen many people do it successfully, but I think you're right. When you do want to get into a little bit more advancement and sophistication, and you want to work more off of really subtle signals, you know, this means lift your shoulder, this means, you know, collect your face, this means counterbend. And I agree that the hackamore, you can send those signals a lot easier. And because it's got this nice frame to it, it really speaks to the horse. And I do want to bring up, you did start to mention it. If anyone is interested in the hackamore, probably don't go with the $15 feed store special. Because
No, definitely not.
It's not going to work quite the same. Those are the ones that they've got like newspaper in the core, and they're not even
good chew toys for the dogs. Yeah,
well,
no.
You guys mention one that they should look. Mention something, and I don't care if you use a brand name. That's fine.
Funny you should mention that. I just posted on YouTube just yesterday a thing that talks all about what to look for when you're buying a hackamore. So it's on Modern Vaquero on YouTube, and it's about a 20-minute video about what to look for when you're buying a hackamore and Makate. And I just put that up yesterday. So,
all right, Jennifer, if you could find that,
folks can take a look at that.
It's on Modern Vaquero on YouTube. Just search Modern Vaquero hackamore, should come up.
And yeah, the title is Hackamore and Makate Buying Tips, I think, is what the title is.
All right, and we'll put it on our Facebook page this morning so that everybody can find it, too.
Oh, that works out perfect.
Great. Yeah. Hey, love it when a plan comes together, even when there's no plan.
I know. Well, and one question
One real quick thing I wanted to touch on, because you mentioned the rope halter, and this will just take a second. One thing with any bitless tool, and I see this a lot, and I'm sure you've seen it a lot with a rope halter, where people train in a rope halter, and the horse is kind of bracing the pole and stick their nose out a little bit. And there's actually a reason for that. There's a facial nerve that runs down under the jawbone, and it's just kind of down below the crease of where the jaw, where that, you know, kind of that half moon of that jawbone is, where their cheek is. And it's in a little different place on different horses. But what happens with some of the bitless tools is as people pick up on those, like the rope halter, or if the hackamore isn't adjusted right, it's too loose, it will hit that nerve and create a brace in the pole, which then creates a brace across the entire top line. So that's just something to kind of for folks to be aware of and kind of take a look at.
Wow, that is something I did not know. One of the questions I think there's a bit of a delay. One of the questions I had about hackamore training is, I think we can agree that if you start a horse with the hackamore and you do it correctly, you're never going to run into that brace and you're going to protect their mouth. But what would you do if I brought you a horse that, had other types of training and he's pretty heavy, pretty bracy, I feel like I need to use a heavier bit. If that horse were to come to you for training, would you put him in the hackamore? And are there certain things you would do to help take the brace out? And because I'd also be worried about safety. You know, is he going to run off and I'm not going to have any control over him?
Yeah, the first thing is, before I even get on a horse like that, is I would make sure that he's going to give right and left of that hackamore. But one of the interesting things that we find, and I actually do this quite a bit in the clinics, this is kind of a common thing that happens. And a lot of times what we find is that when we put the Hackamore on the Horse, because it is so different than what they had been ridden in before, we find a lot of that just doesn't become as much of an issue as it had been in the bit, because the signal is so different. One of the things that I would work on, though, is kind of working some side movements, because when that horse has a little bit of bend in him, they don't feel as strong, so they're not as likely to fight you as they would be if they were straight in their body. So some shoulder in, shoulder out, those kinds of things. But again, once I've got them to where they'll give right and left on the ground and then give right and left under saddle, we're pretty much good to go at that point. And it's really a much easier transition than most people think.
Yeah, I think we do have a little bit of a crutch there when you take the bit out. You know, if you've never really done that before and you think, oh my gosh, where's your control? And I do like a former boss used to say, if you feel like you don't have control, don't worry, you never did anyway.
Exactly. I was always taught the control of
that's
a horse
true. Most
is nothing
things in
but
life.
An illusion.
It's like... That describes life. That's just not horses.
You've never
exactly.
been in control.
Exactly.
And if you get married, that's the saying that should be on your marriage certificate. Right there.
Only if you're the husband. Not
right.
the wife, though.
I'm not even touching that one. I'm old enough to know better now.
That's funny.
Well, one of the things, back to the horses before we all get ourselves in trouble. Control really is just built from good habits and just building good habits with the horses. And once we do that, we have as much control as we're going to, because you certainly can't control out of fear, because if you try to, you only have control until the horse is more afraid of something else other than it is you. So... it's really about building those good habits as we go through the training process.
There's so much more I want to talk about, you know, about the two rein and the spade, which are the next two things. I just want to ask one more question and then we got to go. Oh my gosh. Yeah. And what was that question? It just escaped me. Oh, something you brought up. We were talking on Facebook a few weeks ago, and something you brought up I thought was really interesting. I think we're seeing a trend in folks, you know, exploring this type of training, and they're putting their horses in the two rein and the spade. You know, in terms of time, something you said that really was interesting to me is you said a lot of the really good guys in this style of training said that they were lucky if they got more than one bridle horse trained in their lifetime, because that's kind of what it takes to train a really good one. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. There's kind of an old vaquero proverb that says that if someone has two good bridle horses in their life, that they've been lucky. And if they have one great one, they consider it a gift from God. A lot of what we see today that are labeled bridle horses aren't quite what the old California horsemen would have considered bridle horses. It takes a special kind of horse, and it takes a lot of time. And it's one of those things where I think that the bar has been lowered quite a bit. I see a lot of really good working horses in the bit. I see a lot of good, really good show horses in the bit. But the label bridle horse, what it used to mean and what it means today, maybe aren't quite the same thing. Because when you have people saying that they've made dozens of bridle horses, or I know one guy that says he produces a bridle horse every year, it's not quite the same as the bridle horses that I remember is from back when I was a teenager and that my family had, you know, growing up, and that those old guys that I've talked to, what they remember is as the real bridle horses of California of the old days.
And that just really gets you thinking about the kind of time and effort that it takes to make one of these horses. And so I would love to talk about this more. We may have to have you on yet again, because there's so much to talk about within this one style, but we have to go. So where can people find you online?
Oh, it's CaliforniaBridleHorse.com is the website. And the time flies when I'm with you guys. It just blows by super quick.
Even from Australia at midnight. So we thank you for staying up late to talk to us, too.
Yeah.
We appreciate
you
that.
You bet. And I'd love to be on again. No telling where we'll be talking from, but I'd love to be on again sometime for sure.
Thank you, Jeff Sanders. CaliforniaBridleHorse.com, and we'll let you go get some sleep before your clinics tomorrow.
Sounds good. Have a good one.
All right, take care.
Thanks, Jeff.
Yeah, you know, we don't usually have Australian guests that are live on the show, but because usually it was like 1 o'clock in the morning. But after we change our clocks, they change theirs, and we actually are 2 hours. It's 2 hours less different, if I say it that way. So it's not quite as late. But that's why.
Yeah, and I think there's a few different time zones there.
Yeah, yeah. And that's why we record our Australian episode for Here for Horses in the Morning with Fiona, is because we can't get any guests to wake up at midnight to come on the show. So
I know. It kind of lucked out. And I just wanted to say I'm working out. Nothing's official yet, but it looks like I will be going to Australia myself toward the end of the year.
Yay, that'll be fun.
I know. Cool. It'll be really fun. Well, I'm coming home with a kangaroo.
And I have had a couple listeners ask if you've heard anything from Road to the Horse, and the answer to that question is no. So nothing yet.
Nothing yet. 2D likes to keep things under wraps. And of course, I think this is a really important year to find some good contestants. I know there's a lot of great candidates out there. I'll be excited to see who she comes up with.
Misty asked also, she just sent me a message about the use of a hackamore in English riding, and we'll get to that. Maybe we'll address that on your next episode. We'll talk a little bit more about on the English side of things, because Jennifer uses it. It is pretty popular with certain places on the English side as well. So
there's a show jumper who jumps in a hackamore competitively. Like an actual traditional Western with the horsehair macottes and everything. I know Jeff, and there's many others who go over to Europe and do clinics all the time, and I see people in a dressage saddle in their hackamore.
Very good. Well, let's reset here a little bit. You're listening to Horses in the Morning, the Mary Kitzmiller training episode brought to you by Horseware. We're going to take a break to hear a little bit more about one of Horseware's products, and then we're going to come back and we're going to finish out the show with a bunch more of the listener questions. And Jennifer, we can switch. I think we already have. We're going to make a switch on Jennifer here so we can hear her a little bit better. And we'll be right back after this word from Horseware.
In the world of horse racing and elite equestrian sports, it's all about how to prepare and repair. IceVibe is a truly portable and highly efficient circulation therapy system for your horse. Before activity, prepare to prevent damage by using the IceVibe's vibration pads. Repair after the event by using the unique combination of cold packs and vibration to minimize swelling and encourage blood flow. And because it's battery powered, IceVibe is truly portable. The essential and affordable tool to prepare and repair. IceVibe.
You can find out more details about IceVibe at ice-vibe.com or horseware.com, or ask your local tack shop or online supplier for more information about IceVibe circulation therapy from Horseware. Well, we are back, and today we're going to go into the next listener question for Mary and Jennifer today. This was sent in by Joyce McKinney, and it was, does Mary ever use draw reins or a training fork? Only when she's eating something good.
Did someone say fork?
I figured you were probably getting hungry. Mary likes to eat.
I haven't had any breakfast.
I know. Mary likes her breakfast, as I learned when we went to Road to the Horse. And have you had your first Diet Coke yet?
No.
God, you must be dying.
I'm dying. We were talking earlier about the fancy pizza establishment I went to, and they didn't have Coke products. I was only able to get a stevia-flavored, all-natural diet drink, and it was terrible. It was so healthy, I thought I was going to die.
All right, I don't think she's talking about actually forks you eat with.
So, okay, yes.
Yeah, so Joyce asked, does Mary ever use draw reins or training forks?
You know, I never say never. I think there's a lot of great equipment out there that has its use. And in the past, I have used the forks or the draw reins. I don't really use anything like that now because in the case of draw reins, I've noticed there's no real give for the horse with the draw reins. Even if they do get on the bit or they, you know, they find themselves in the position you're looking for, the draw reins seem to constantly continue to pull on their face. So they just don't ever find any kind of relief. And it's easier with draw reins to continue to pull harder and harder and harder until you really got your horse bound up. And then anytime you take them off, the horse knows they're not on anymore and they're free to do, they're a little bit more free to do what they want. So I'm not big into draw reins. The training fork is something that I'm not opposed to using, but I do see it often misused. And I used to judge an Arabian show where it was a schooling show and I was allowed to give comments to the riders. And one of the things I'd always have them do, a lot of these kids on these Arabians rode in these little training forks. And one of the things I'd always have them do is loosen them way, way up. Because if I see the reins make kind of a V shape, like the rein goes from the bit down to the training fork and up to your hands, that is way, way too tight. And all you're doing is tying the horse's head down. You might as well just wear a tie down. And again, once you take that piece of equipment off, the horse is not going to continue to stay in frame. So what I would use a training fork for, if I were so inclined, is on a horse that likes to really flip its head up. And I would have the fork set so that when the horse has a relaxed head position or they're on the bit, that fork does not have any pull on the reins whatsoever. It is loose. It's not active at all. But if the horse throws his head way, way up, the fork will stop them from doing that. And again, even in those cases, I find that if a horse is tossing his head like that, there's a good reason that needs to be addressed. And it could be teeth. It could be he's out somewhere in his body, maybe needs some body work. It could be anxiety, in which case there's a lot of other things that I'll do before I'd go to a training fork.
Yeah. Could be that the rider has sucky hands.
That too.
Yeah.
And any type of restraint like that, especially if you're not careful and tactful with pressure, you're in a real danger of putting your horse in such a bind that he's going to do what it takes to escape. And I mean, that could be rearing up, flipping over, running off. Yeah.
I can't add much more to that. I completely comply. Those tools have a place in the hands of a genuinely experienced rider. But I agree with you. They're way overused. They take the place of time and teaching the horse good communication tools. They get used by riders who shouldn't be trying to teach a horse to carry himself in a frame. He's got no business trying to teach that. So I'm on your page too. There you go.
Perfect. I love it when we agree.
I hate it when...
And Diet Coke for breakfast is awesome.
I hate it when the women in my life fight. So this is good. All right. Stephanie sent in the next one. What to do with a thoroughbred that can't... let's see. That's similar to the one we had before. So let's go on to the next one. This is from Robin. I have wondered recently about ground tying. Is this something that's a good idea to teach my horse? I'm a trail rider, so I always have the fear that ground tying would not be safe. But at the same time, it sure would be helpful if I could know that my horse would stand there no matter what if I need her to.
Yes, I think ground tying is always a good idea, you know, no matter what kind of discipline you're riding. And it has more benefit to it than simply convenience. You know, if you don't have a place to tie your horse and you need him to stay still, I think it's a great exercise that teaches patience and emotional control in your horse, which is something I don't think we work on enough. And this is something I work on with Guthrie quite a bit, because when I do demos, he tends to get really playful and he wants to follow me around when I'm trying to talk. So I've taught him, you know, you go over there and you stand there until I'm ready for you. And I find it's really helped him everywhere else, just learn to be more patient. Now, ground tying, when she talks about her...
Can you explain that for somebody who might not know what you're talking about?
Yeah, yeah. I was just looking at... She was worried about it being safe. I think some folks think that to ground tie, you need to take the rein, if you have split reins, and put it on the ground, which some people do, and that's a signal to the horse to stay put. I don't really do that. On the off chance my horse does, you know, something spooks him or he does leave, I don't want him stepping on my nice expensive reins and pulling on his mouth and hurting himself. So I'll leave my reins up. Some folks will use hobbles to either train a ground tie, or, you know, if you're out branding cattle and there's no place to tie a horse, you want to put some sort of restraint on them to make sure they don't go wandering off. There's a lot of controversy surrounding hobbles, but I don't have any problem with them as long as you do it correctly. And there's absolutely a way to train with hobbles that will not involve your horse hurting itself or panicking. That is a whole process, you know, and I teach it first with the lariat and teach them to give their feet and all of that. You don't have to use hobbles to train a ground tie. And how I start it is, and again, to be clear, ground tying is when I dismount my horse, if I'm in the middle of the arena, I want him to stay put until until I'm ready for him. So if I'm riding my horse around and I realize, oh, darn it, I forgot to put on my helmet, my helmet's on the gate, maybe I'll just leave my horse in the middle of the arena while I go get my helmet, put it on, go back to my horse. He's standing there nice and patiently.
Yep. Really handy skill when you have to take your jumps up and down all the time. You're moving jumps around, fixing rails. It's so nice to have a horse that will ground tie.
Exactly. They don't go wandering off, or they don't follow you while you're trying to carry the poles. And so I start it pretty simply. I time it to where I don't do it when the horse is fresh and full of beans. I might start training the ground tie at the end of my ride. So he might be a little tired. He might be really hoping for a nice rest, and you just take that opportunity. I'll just dismount him, and I might give him a signal that says, okay, we're ground tying now. I might say, whoa. And then I just kind of drop the reins and I might start walking around them. And I'll be close enough that I can help them out if they decide to move. And if they move, some folks approach this differently. I'm not going to punish you for moving because you don't know. You don't know what I'm teaching you. So if they move, I just put them right back exactly where I have them. You know, I may need to back them up, yield their hindquarters. I put them right back there, drop the reins, say, whoa, again, and start walking around. You know, I don't just leave and go on vacation because they're obviously not going to pass that test. And then, you know, I just build on how long I can leave you standing every day. You know, maybe I can get them to stand for a few moments the first day. And then the next day when I get off, maybe a few more moments to where maybe they can stand for 5 minutes. Now, on the trail, I wouldn't really be dependent on a great ground tie if you haven't worked on it a lot in the arena. So I wouldn't just drop, you know, leave your horse and then go down the trail a couple of miles, because you have no recourse if he does decide to leave or something pops up and scares him. But it might be helpful if you need to leave him stay put for a few moments while you go get something or adjust something.
And the other thing Mary learned is it's not always a good idea to go to the outhouse and ground tie your horse.
Exactly.
Yeah, Mary learned that the hard way.
That was actually the catalyst for me to perfect my ground tying.
Because occasionally, even in the middle of a show, you have to go to the bathroom. So
exactly.
Yes. That's funny. All right, we have one more, and it's a little bit similar to one of the others. But Hillary asked, and a couple people wanted to know this too. Would love to hear Mary's approach to helping horses that pull back when tied. And we've all had those horses, right, in the past, that when you tie them up, they just pull back, and it's always a disaster in the making. So, what do you say to that one?
That is a really good one. In fact, I'm going to be working with a horse next week that has this problem. You cannot hard tie this horse. It will destroy everything. And the last owners actually tied it to some panels, and It already had a problem of pulling back. Well,
yeah, and we're going to tie it to panels.
One of them ended up in the emergency room.
Yeah, no kidding.
Everyone was okay. So I'm working with a very troubled horse. First of all, I wouldn't go, if I had a horse that had a problem pulling back, I wouldn't go straight to, okay, let's tie you up and see what happens. The horse has a panic response to pressure. And most horses, to be clear, do not naturally want to give to pressure. They would rather oppose pressure. They don't want to feel trapped. That prey instinct is going to kick in and say, I can't be trapped. I need to move. And they will naturally kind of go against pressure. So we need to teach them how to give to a feel. And when you feel pressure, give to it. This is going to keep you safe. This is going to help you find release. So I would just start with that horse, probably like I do any other, working on the ground, doing my groundwork. And a big part of my groundwork is getting them to follow a feel. So I do a lot of exercises with the halter. I mentioned this, like being able to send my horse earlier, where I pick up on that halter. And when they feel that halter kind of wrap a little tighter behind their ears, instead of pulling back, they need to go forward. And I can use my training flag or the end of my rope to help me. If they do start to panic, I can create a little bit of energy behind them. And once they find that forward, I release. So they feel that, you know, that's where the pressure goes away, is when you come forward. So lots of that certainly helps. You know, I'll work them on a halter. And this is an exercise I do a lot because it has so many uses for it. And this isn't like lunging, but it is getting the horse to move a circle around you. You know, I'll point and pick up a feel on that halter, and I want my horse to step, follow that feel, step out onto that circle, move forward. When I tip your nose towards your hindquarters, you need to yield your hindquarters, and then I'll switch hands on the rope and then send you the other way. And I'll do that. You can't overdo that. I do it at a walk, so you can't tire them out. You can do it for hours on end if you wanted to. So that really helps the horse to learn to follow the feel. Now, when it comes time to actually tying, there's a couple of things I'll do. I've got a safety tie thing that's sort of like the blocker tie ring. This one is called the clip, and it's a tie. I use it a lot for trailering because if your horse falls down, or they pull back or they panic, they'll stay tied with this tool, but it will give them the slack they need. I like it a lot for trailering because, you know, again, if I'm in an accident, I don't want my horses hanging if the trailer flips or anything. I want them to be able to pull slack so that they have enough, you know, they have enough halter, lead rope to feel safe. So that's one thing that I'll use, is I'll put them on that and start tying from there. And if they pull back, I just walk right back up to them and take the slack out of the rope. And then, you know, I let them explore that feeling. The horse is still tied. Obviously, I'm not going to put them on this clip tie thing and then just leave them. You know, I'm going to watch them because obviously, you know, they have a problem. They need supervision. But I find that if the horse is able to pull some rope, if he freaks out and thinks, oh, I'm trapped, and he starts going backwards and the rope comes with him, he would think that would teach him to pull back. But I found it has the opposite effect. He goes, oh, okay. Okay, I can get rope if I need to. Okay, I think I can stand here. And if I just continue to walk back up and just gently lead them back up and pull slack from the rope and get them back to where they were, I find that they don't do that very long before they are able to let up and say, okay, it's okay, I can do this, I'm not trapped. And then from there, I can start slowly messing around with tying them fast and hard. And I use a bowline knot instead of a slip knot. I don't use a slip knot because a slip knot, when I tie, will not, it will tighten up and it will not have a safety release if the horse really pulls back. So the bowline knot, which you can look, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it right, but you can probably find a YouTube video for it. I modified it, put my own safety release in it, but it won't suck up onto that tie ring and get really tight. I can still get it undone with my fingers if I have to.
Jennifer, anything to add to that?
I think that was very thorough. I really like the that you use the, I think you called it the clip.
Yes.
I'm familiar with the product because I was next to him at a trade show once and spent about 6 days in a row watching him do his thing. I think it was at World Equestrian Games. I like that a lot. Have you ever used, and this is a method we learned way back in the day when I was in Pony Club, so it probably has its roots in the UK, when you teach initially teach a horse to tie, or to try to teach a horse to tie that tends to pull back, is you tie them to a sturdy wall or tree or whatever it is. You run the rope through the halter ring and then down between their front legs, and you make a loop around their rib cage, and you tie that fast so it stays on the rib cage, so that when they pull on their rib cage instead of the halter. I have never tried it. I've read it in lots of books. Have you ever tried it? Are you familiar with it at all?
Yes, I have. And the reason that wasn't my go-to, the reason I didn't come out the gate with that is because I've only tried it once or twice. But the first time I saw it was at a Chris Cox clinic. We were starting colts. And the colt I had, she was supposed to be halter broke, but she didn't even seem that trained. We had to back the trailer up to the round pen to unload her, and I had to rope her to catch her. So she was off a ranch in New Mexico, as wild and woolly as you can get without being a Mustang. And after we had put a few days on her, and, you know, I'm riding her around, he took her as a demo, and he says, okay, we're going to tie her up. And he did just what you're saying. He took a long rope and it tied it around her, like her girth area, and then went up through her front legs and through, I think he even went through the throat latch of the halter and then through the ring. And then he just tied her just right there. And he goes, and she's good. And she did sit back a little bit, but because it's not pulling directly on their head, it was hardly anything to write home about. She kind of sat down, felt it pull behind her elbows and goes, oh, and then she was tied. And he said, now, you know, you can just tie them like that, even if they've never been tied, even if they pull back. And after that, you know, she had a couple sessions where I did that. Then you were pretty much just able to tie her. And like I said, I've had this question before, and I've always thought to mention this, but because I've only really seen it and tried it once or twice, it's not something I feel comfortable to say, oh, yeah, everyone should do this.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I imagine if you get the wrong type of rope, get it attached wrong, if the horse get it tied the wrong direction, the wrong length, things could go south in a hurry if you use this method incorrectly.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And anytime that's why I feel more safe to recommend something like a tie ring or the clip, because now I did have a friend lose a thumb on a tie ring.
Ah!
But it was a total... So you can get hurt doing anything, but you're less likely to run into too much of a bind. And I will say, even if your horse ties really well, it's always a good idea to have a knife on you. You just never know.
There you go.
Very good. Well, thank you, everybody, for submitting your questions. We appreciate that. Mary, thank you so much for taking the time to answer them. Maybe we'll do a little bit of that every month when you come by. We are going to let you go get your Diet Coke and your breakfast before somebody in that little town in Texas loses a life. So we don't want that to happen. Now, you'll probably have to find a place to find a Diet Coke this early. That's going to be your
only problem. There's no McDonald's here. I don't even know what to do.
There's a town in this country that has no McDonald's?
Not that I've seen. And there's no Walmart?
What are you going to do?
I know.
You cannot stay there for more than 2 days. You'll just go crazy.
This is like the last frontier. I don't even like Walmart, but something about the glow of that,
the neon lights.
Comforting.
Yes.
Right.
Yes. It's a religious experience. You feel that warm blue glow and you're like, everything's going to be okay.
There's civilization. You know, other places do have coffee. I just want to say, other than McDonald's, I just want to say that. Okay.
I don't do coffee. I do Diet Coke.
Oh, that's right. Well, other places do have Diet Coke too. You know, they do.
Is there a gas station?
Yeah,
they frequently have a soda machine.
Yeah, you can at least get.
Yeah, their fountain drinks taste weird.
Oh, you have to be a fountain Diet Coke. It can't be a canned
can't
Diet
just
Coke.
Be a canned.
No, because they go flat too quick. Remember, I'm like the finicky toddler. who goes to a five-star restaurant and gets macaroni and cheese.
You know what? It was so funny because we were doing Road to the Horse, what, 4 or 5 days in a row there. And every morning she would come in with the McDonald's, like, super-sized Diet Coke. And this was 8 o'clock in the morning. It was... You know that
caffeine does nothing to me now. It's kind of like oxygen. It just I need to survive. But it gives me no, it doesn't give me any pep in my step, nothing.
You know it's really not good for you. You're gonna get emails, right? You realize that.
Yeah.
Just tell probably. Everybody you know that that 25 Diet Cokes a day are not good for you. Go ahead and admit that you know that and you're gonna do it anyway.
Apologize to Dr. Ellen and do it right now.
Yeah, just tell Dr. Ellen, who's listening right now, just cringing, that you already realize that and she doesn't need to send
apologize.
You an email.
Say you're sorry.
Yeah, say you're sorry.
It could be worse. I could be on meth.
And on that, we're going to call it a day. You can visit Mary's website at marykitzmiller.com. And don't forget, the reason that she's in this little town in the middle of nowhere is for a show where they're selling their really cool artwork. And people can buy that artwork on your website, right?
Yes, I have a few pieces up there, and I'll be adding more soon.
Very good. Well, good luck this weekend. I hope you sell tons of stuff down there. What's it called again?
Petticoats on the Prairie.
Do you have a petticoat? Do you even own a petticoat?
No, I don't. I don't. Now,
do
back
you own
in
a
Oklahoma,
dress?
I
didn't think so.
That's a good question. Yeah. I may still have one of my old prom dresses hanging around.
We're going to get Mary in a dress one of these days. We'll have to get that accomplished. Well,
I've always wanted to go to a ball. So, you know, if that opportunity ever comes up, then... I'm game.
All right. Well, there's a big party every year at the Thoroughbred Makeover. You're going to have to buy a dress.
Okay, we'll do.
All right. We're going to have to, but then we'll get to see Mary in a dress then. Well, thanks everybody for joining us. Don't forget, really bad ads tomorrow. Jennifer, do you need some really bad ads?
I need ads.
Okay, send them to Jennifer at horseradionetwork.com. Just get on Craigslist. You'll find some really crappy ads pretty quick. Send them over to Jennifer at horseradionetwork.com with the really bad ads in the subject line and copy and paste the entire ad into the email, pictures and all. That way they go away a lot of times before we get to them. So we don't want to miss your ad. And we have some terrific prizes this month. So you have an opportunity to win those also. Jamie, I confirmed, is home. So she'll be back tomorrow. I know all of you are going, is Jamie ever coming back? She'll be back tomorrow from her little vacation to Hawaii. It's a rough life. Thanks, everybody. We'll see you tomorrow. Bye, Mary.
Bye.
You can leave the parking lot now.